Hi, I'm Don Genova, and you're listening to a podcast recorded in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, called All You Can Eat. All You Can Eat is part of the Culinary Podcast Network. Make sure you check out the CPN at culinarypodcastnetwork.com. This week marks the 50th anniversary of the Hungarian Uprising. The events of that week in Hungary also marked the beginning of a flood of Hungarian immigration to North America. Earlier this summer, I welcomed Joanne Sasvari to my back deck for a chat and a cooking lesson. Joanne is the author of Paprika, a spicy memoir from Hungary.
So, Joanne, welcome to the back deck of Cobble Hill.
Well, thanks a lot. It's great to be here.
We are going to make one of the recipes from your book, and probably one of the simpler ones.
Yes, it is. It is one of the simpler ones. Like a lot of the Hungarian food, the classic traditional dishes, it's very simple, very easy, but it does take a bit of time. So, you know, the idea is you cook it, sit back, have a glass of wine, relax, and enjoy.
I like it. Okay, so tell me what we're making and what to do first.
Well, we're going to start making a beef perkelt. And perkelt is kind of a stew thing. And it's the basis for, well, you can eat it on its own as a stew. You can put sour cream in it and make it into a paprikash. Or you can add water to it and simmer it for many hours. And then it becomes goulash or guyash, as it's properly pronounced. People think guyash is a stew, but the stew is actually called perkelt. And then the water and the potatoes and stuff make it into the guyash itself. So we're going to start with a little bit of onion. Just like every good Hungarian recipe starts with an onion. And every good Hungarian fairy tale starts with an onion, too.
Uh-oh. Fairy tales?
Well, it's sort of like the traditional. You always have some little, you know, some young lad, and he's going off on his adventure, and he always travels with an onion in his sack, because as long as he's got an onion, he's never going to go hungry.
So am I just chopping it?
Yeah, just chop it, you know, fairly fine, just into, you know, a sort of a rough dice.
Okay. Now, how did this whole book come about? Because as I started reading it, it sounded like you started off with a little project and turned into a big project.
Well, it was one of those funny things where my family is Hungarian. They came over in 1956 after the Hungarian uprising, and I started just sort of out of the blue, really becoming interested in their stories. And it suddenly occurred to me as I was, you know, listening to their stories and talking about, you know, things that had happened in the family, that every story in our family had to do with food. And then I got really intrigued by the food itself and started thinking, okay, great, I'm going to find some Hungarian cookbooks and learn how to cook Hungarian. And then I couldn't find any. So it became sort of a good idea to actually write my own. And what I've come up with is a culinary memoir, and it's a travelogue, and it's also a collection of recipes and history about the food and how this cuisine came into being and how the cuisine is completely inseparable from all the historical stuff that happened, the invasion of the Turks or the occupation of the Turks, the thing with Austria, the thing with the Italians. I mean, all of that is on your plate there.
But you were totally not into your Hungarian heritage when you were younger.
Oh, no. I was embarrassed. And I hated the food. I mean, I just hate it. I hate the smell of paprika. Oh, no. Never loved that at all. And it was quite a big change for me. And I mean, I loved the Italian, loved the Thai, loved all the good, you know, cuisines. And learning to cook Hungarian was really interesting because it was so different in so many ways, and it was sort of a big turnaround for me to actually admit, okay, I kind of like this stuff after all.
Hmm. But so then how did you go about doing it? Because, like you said, you didn't find the cookbooks. There were only a few there.
There's only a few. Well, I traveled to Hungary and discovered that, and this kind of made me really excited because, I mean, you know, if you come from a Hungarian background in Canada, you grew up with this, the perkelt and the guyash and, you know, the traditional dishes. But the traditional cuisine itself is much more complex. It's one of the most sophisticated, or used to be anyway, one of the most sophisticated cuisines in the world. And went to Hungary, discovered these amazing ingredients, you know, beautiful duck and wild game and wild mushrooms and, you know, the cherries and the apricots. And I actually found that all the food I really, really like is like the old Hungarian food that I'd never actually eaten, you know, and went there and then found all these chefs who are completely excited about creating this new cuisine, which is actually the very old cuisine, and bringing it into the modern era. And they're bringing back traditional ingredients like the mangalitsa pig or the gray cattle, which is this wonderful lean beef. And it's this really exotic looking thing with, you know, horns as wide as a bus. And, you know, and they almost died out during the Soviet era when it was all about collective farms and mass production and blah, blah. And now it's all sort of coming back, you know, in small forms, but it's pretty exciting.
But I guess when your parents came here, they didn't have those ingredients to deal with anyway.
No, they didn't. My mother also wasn't, I mean, she didn't really know how to cook when she came here, and she wasn't the best of cooks, and, you know, I promise not to insult her anymore, but but I didn't really learn a lot from her. My grandmother was a great cook, and she came over at the same time, and what they ended up doing was, you know, replacing, like, the very fine, delicate, sweet Hungarian peppers with our, you know, brawny bell peppers, and it's not the same taste at all. But, you know, they kind of made do, and, you know, the cuisine is pretty good at, you know, accommodating poverty, which is a good thing. You know, when you keep going into wars and, you know, rebellions and occupation, it's kind of good to be able to feed yourself when you're poor.
Okay, on the side burner of the barbecue, I've got a cast iron enameled cast iron pot on the go, and I happen to have in my pantry, in the fridge downstairs, some duck fat, which apparently is the best thing to do Hungarian cooking in, or goose fat or something
goose
like that.
Goose fat. Yeah. Hungary is, I think it's still the biggest producer of foie gras and duck liver, and it's cheap there. It's awesome. You go to Hungary and you get these little pots of foie gras and you eat it with onions, and oh, it is so amazing. But yes.
How much do I want to put in?
A fair chunk.
A fair chunk? Is that?
That should be good, I think, yes.
There it goes. It's sliding around down in there.
Now, in Hungary itself, people have tended to go away from the lard and the goose fat to vegetable oil because everybody's, you know, health conscious there as well. But
the flavor, though. The flavor.
I know. It's not the same flavor.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So we're going to let that stir around in there. I found the story of how your parents met and how they came to Canada. I was just absolutely fascinated. I was reading the book on a plane ride that I had. I could not put it down. I didn't watch the movie on the plane. I just was so fascinated. The story of your grandmother and what your grandmother went through. And tell me a bit about your grandmother, because she's there at the front of the book and has to be an amazing inspiration to you.
My grandmother was an amazing woman. She went through so much turmoil in her life, and she was just this little, I mean, she was like 4'11" and this complete ball of fire. She married my grandfather when she was, I guess, in her 20s. His family was very wealthy. Hers was not. They cut the family off without a penny. They went on. They had three children. They survived the First World War. They lost all their money. They lost everything. Then they survived the Second World War, and they lost everything again. They survived years of Soviet occupation. And then in their 50s, they packed up and, you know, fled the country under gunfire and came to Canada and started all over again. She was an amazing, amazing woman.
And she ran a restaurant. Her husband and her brother just
drank the profits. Yes, my grandfather, on the other hand, was a bit of a rascal. He liked the girls. He liked the gambling. He liked the booze, and it made her life very difficult. So she was a bit cranky about that at times, but she was remarkable, and she was the kind of woman who, you know, she never left the house without her fur and her diamonds. She never, even when she really didn't have any. And she always made amazing food, and she was pretty astonishing. She could do anything. I mean, she died when she was in her late 80s, and a couple of years before she died, she was up on the roof fixing her own roof. If I can be like that, that would be pretty awesome.
Yeah. Now, what I've got here is some cross rib steak that says it's for simmering, and that's what we're going to be doing. I'm going to cut this into chunks, but how big should the chunks be? Kind of like beef, regular beef stew size?
Yeah, a little bit, you know, sort of 1-inch squarish, okay. Sort of bite size.
All right, there we go. We're getting that. And I love the stories of them burying family fortunes, which never actually worked out, did it?
No. Every time they had to flee, whether it was the Germans or the Russians or the Allies or the Hungarians or whatever, they took all their jewelry and gold and their silver, and they would bury it in the garden, and then they would never find it again. So in little places all over Hungary, you will be able to find, if you have, you know, good luck, a little stash of gold and silver.
And then the Soviet era food was just, and there were these cafeterias that they went to work in? And...
Well, during the Soviet era, I mean, I don't really know this firsthand, so I only know from the stories people have told me. And it sounds like the variety and the selection went way down. Well, first of all, people couldn't get access to game, and game was always a huge part of the Hungarian cuisine. And the reason they couldn't get access to game was because the Soviets didn't allow private citizens to own guns just in case, you know, they used it on them instead. And then you had these big collective farms where they basically grew crops like, you know, sugar beets and potatoes and carrots. And, you know, you didn't have all the wonderful herbs and, you know, fine, you know, fruit and vegetables. And the farmers markets, which were such a huge part of the society, basically died because everything went into these supermarkets instead. And, but now all of that's coming back, and there's some spectacular markets. It's just beautiful.
Now, you went there when you were a young girl first, right? For the first time?
We went the first time as a little kid. And then when I was a teenager, my parents sent us to a summer school to learn how to speak English. And yeah, it was really interesting.
No, to speak Hungarian.
So, sorry, to speak Hungarian.
You knew how to speak English.
Well, some days it's kind of debatable.
And the thread throughout all of this, too, is the house.
The house
that your grandparents had.
When they were very wealthy, they built this beautiful summer home on the north shore of Lake Balaton. And my grandfather and his sister kind of shared it. Like she and her family lived on one side, and he and his family lived on the other. And when they lost everything, when everything was taken away, when they were very poor, when basically the Soviets had sent them off into this internment camp way out in, you know, the boonies, they still had the house, and the house was their refuge. They would always come back to it. And the last time they came back to it before they fled, because people weren't supposed to own private property under the communist rule, the communists had put another family into their half of the house as well. So they ended up having to share the house with these other people. I can't imagine my grandmother sharing her kitchen with anyone. It must have been quite the scenario. But yes, that house was kind of a very romantic place. And I've been there, and it's just this beautiful old place. But in the 80s, they kind of bought the house outright from the family, and now they've not done anything with it. So for 20 years, it's been sitting there, falling to pieces, and you know... It's really quite sad.
A very sad moment when you went back with your mother to see it like that. And even the first time you went back with your partner, Lionel, it was really hard for you emotionally.
Well, it really was, because up until that point, I'd always kind of thought, you know, all this stuff about the communists, you know, oh yeah, whatever, you know, you guys are all just being a bunch of drama queens about it. But then I actually went back and saw it, and it made it so real, you know, the loss and that... I know this is only a house. It's not a life or anything, but that sort of somehow came to represent all the loss of this, you know, this once beautiful and gracious country that turned into this, you know, really sad place for a very, very long time. And even now it's kind of gotten better, but now it's kind of not so great. And, you know, the economy's again sort of really wobbly and a lot of corruption. And, you know, and for a few years it was so magnificent. And to me, the house kind of just... Seeing this beautiful, graceful building, you know, with the big rocks falling out of the walls and the shutters hanging open and the windows empty, it was pretty sad.
And then your mother says, oh, that's where we buried the Russian, which
yes.
You never got to the bottom of, right? Or at least in the book you didn't reveal.
No, this was one of the things that I found. And actually, this is probably the most moving thing, I think, to me in a lot of ways, where people who lived through that don't talk about it. You know, I mean, you hear a lot of stories about the First World War and the Second World War, but I find, because I've talked to a lot of people since the book came out who came from the Ukraine or from Romania or, you know, other parts of sort of Eastern Europe, and they never talk about what happened. So you get these little oblique references to, you know, something that did go on, and you go, what do you mean? What do you mean the dead Russian? What dead Russian? And all you get is, you know, he was a Russian. He was dead. We put him in a wardrobe. Okay, then. That's very clarifying. Thanks.
That was it. Okay, now I've browned the onions. I've taken them off the heat.
Okay.
What's the next step here?
Oops, sorry.
Have I browned them enough? Is the question.
You have browned them
maybe too much.
Maybe a little bit too much, but that's okay.
That's okay. Well,
that's fine as long as they're sort of, you know, cooked. Now right. The key.
I get the talking and we get carried away.
Well, I know the stories are always so great. So the key when you're cooking with paprika, because paprika is a slight is it's like most. Spices are like seeds or stems or roots and they're dried, but paprika is actually made from the wall of the pepper, of a hot red pepper or a sweet red pepper. And because it's made from a pepper, it's very high in sugar. So you have to take whatever it is off the heat and then stir in the paprika.
Okay. And so you have some mild paprika. Now, how do you pronounce it? Some people say paprika. Some people say paprika.
Well, in Hungarian, you'd call it paprika.
Paprika. Okay.
But the English, or, you know, sort of in English, always tends to become paprika.
Mm-hmm. So I have, what do we want, a couple of teaspoons?
2 teaspoons. Now, what I like to do with this is to put in 2 teaspoons of the sweet or mild, and then about 1/2 teaspoon of hot paprika as well.
Okay.
And the hot can be very, very hot, so you don't want to go too overboard with it. And I find, well, some people like it, but I find that it's, you just don't have any subtlety of flavor. And
it even smells hotter. Just when you put your nose in a can.
Yeah. And the thing is, paprika doesn't really have much flavor or very little flavor until you cook it, you put heat and some sort of liquid on it. So that's when you actually release the aromas, you release the flavor. And until then, it's kind of just, it's kind of, well, that's why you can put it on, you know, deviled eggs. And all it does is make them look pretty, but it doesn't really change the taste of them at all.
But as I add that to the warm onions, it is releasing those aromas in there.
I know. It's quite amazing, isn't it?
Okay. So that's all mixed up.
Okay. Is it thoroughly stirred in?
Thoroughly stirred in.
Okay. Now, what you do is you throw in the beef. And because the paprika has quite a bit of sugar in it, it sort of caramelizes the beef. And this is a different stewing process. Like Western stews, you tend to... you braise them in a liquid, in a wine or a stock or water or whatever. But this being kind of from more of an Asian tradition, the beef actually stews in its own juices, literally. And so you just cover it thoroughly so it's all covered. And then it kind of marinates, it kind of caramelizes. And as you cook it, it starts releasing its own juices and creates this wonderful savory sauce.
Okay, so this is going to go back on the heat now?
It'll go back on the heat, but turn quite low, because you want the collagens to sort of break up and sort of turn into little gelatin and just taste amazing.
Okay, here we go. Back. That pot's a little bit hot, so I will use my trusty towel as a pot holder. Try not to burn it.
And you'll want to put a lid on it as well to keep all the liquid inside. And I'm kind of glad we're doing this outside here because traditionally, this was what the original Magyar tribes, who came from the Ural Mountains, sort of in Western Siberia, and it was kind of like I think they were kind of an Asian tribe, and they left, I think 2,000 years before. You know, BC, traveled down around the mountains, came across the top of the Black Sea, and then eventually ended up into the area that's now known as Hungary. And all that time, they were little bands of warriors, and they could beat off fight off much bigger
enemies.
Thank you very much. and one of the reasons that they could do that was because they could always eat on the hoof. And they also became farmers. They became very famous for these huge herds of cattle that they would, you know, drive across the plains, you know, to market in Germany or wherever. And the way they survived is that they would always have one sickly cow, and along the way they would slaughter the cow, and this is the dish that they would make. They would make it without paprika because they didn't get paprika until, you know, the 17th century or 18th century, really, when it became part of the cuisine. But all those years, they would basically have these pots. Every horseman would have a pot tied to his saddle, and they'd, like, you know, stop on the, you know, on the plain, on the pusta, and make a fire and make this. And it's very hearty. It's full of great nutrients. It keeps you going, and it's easy.
So where did the peppers then come from originally? They're a New World thing, right?
They're a New World thing. They came from South America, and they were in the luggage of Christopher Columbus and his crew. His doctor, actually, was the one who thought, hey, this is kind of cool. And for quite a long time, the Spaniards, of course, it landed in Spain first, used it as an ornamental plant. When the Turks, the Ottomans, were sort of, you know, doing their little marauding through the Mediterranean, they would stop and pick up the peppers, and they thought they were cool, and they traveled with them. And you can see all through the areas where the Ottomans sort of went, you know, southern Italy and northern Africa, Turkey, then up through Bulgaria, Serbia, and into Hungary, you can see these kind of peppers. And back then, they were very, very, very hot. And it wasn't until, like, the 1920s that they actually created hybrids that were sweet and mild and, you know, more flavorful rather than, you know, rip the roof of your mouth off hot.
Now, I've learned, because I'm Sicilian, how different cultures affect the cuisine. And it's a similar story. Had all these conquering nations come through Hungary the same way as Sicily, and it left all these different influences.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the Hungarians are still rather bitter about the, you know, 160-year Turkish occupation. However, the Turks brought them coffee, phyllo pastry, sour cherries, the pita breads that in Hungarian cuisine are known as langos. They're these deep-fried bread dough things, and oh my God, they're so good. And, I mean, a lot of the cuisine, and of course the paprika, came from the Turks. So, you know, I mean, yeah, it wasn't so great, but on the other hand, it wasn't so bad either.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we're going to make one more dish, which is the cucumber salad.
Mm-hmm.
So stand by for that.
You're listening to All You Can Eat on the Culinary Podcast Network. I'm Don Genova. And now we head back to the deck and part two of Paprika, a spicy memoir from Hungary with author Joanne Sasvari.
All right, we are back. The, what do you call it again?
The Perkult.
The Perkult is bubbling away. There's steam escaping from the lid. I can't turn it any lower on this gas thing. We're a little bit worried about that, but we'll let it go for a while and see what happens. We might have to add a little water, you think, later?
Yes. If it starts to really sort of dry out at all, just put a little water in there and just make sure it stays moist.
Yeah. So if the steam stops, then we know we're in trouble.
Yes. You might want to check it every once in a while just to make sure that it's not.
I'm going to check it right now. Oh, no, it's all right. It's okay.
It's amazing how much moisture is actually in
the
meat.
Yeah, it's very moist in there now, yeah. And the meat has really shrunk a lot, too.
Yes, it sort of gets down to its essence. So you get this very, very intensely flavorful thing with this, you know, really very savory and lovely little sauce to go with.
Okay, we're going to do a cucumber salad now.
Now, this is one of the real classic have with every meal kinds of things. There's a real tradition of pickling and things that are kind of pickle-y. If you go to the big market in Budapest, down on the bottom floor, there's a whole row of savanyúság, they call it, which means sour things. And you go in, and they have these little stalls with like 24 different kinds of pickled things. It's awesome. Like everything from sauerkraut to pickled peppers to pickled carrots. It's pretty amazing. This is not actually pickled, but it's kind of got that pickle-y kind of a flavor to it. So we start with a cucumber. And you want to try and get as much of the moisture out of it as possible, so you slice it very fine.
All right. I'm going to cheat because for slicing fine, I have a mandolin.
A mandolin is a very good idea. You don't have to do the Hungarian peasant woman thing. So now just toss it with the dressing, and there you are.
All right. And the goulash, when it's ready, we're not going to take it to its full conclusion here. You just basically serve that over egg noodles. Oh, but you put in some sour cream, though.
Well,
or that's when you take it from a Perkult
to paprikash.
To paprikash. Okay.
Yes. No. So how you would do it is you would let it stew for a while, probably about an hour or so, until the meat's just falling apart. It's just, you know, just falling to little pieces, and then you would stir in about, I don't know, a cup of sour cream or something like that. And then it would become this very lovely, creamy, rich kind of thing. And then, yes, you could serve it over dumplings or egg noodles or on its own with potatoes, any of those things. Or if you had a big crowd coming, you could make it into a goulash. And this is one of the great fun things in Hungarian culture. They call it a bogracsa because the pot it's made in is called a bogracs. And what they do is they cook it over an open fire outside. And it simmers for like 3 hours or more. And you get the wonderful smokiness of the wood smoke sort of intermingled with the paprika and the peppers and the meat and all that. You let the stew cook again for about an hour or so until the meat's falling apart. Then you add water. And then you let it simmer for, you know, an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours until it's just so tender. And then an hour before it's ready, you chop in some potatoes and some carrots and some parsnips if you like. Some people like to add caraway seeds. I'm not so crazy about that. But other people I know like to add dumplings, which I think, you know, who needs the extra work, personally?
Yes.
And then you let it sit and cook for another hour or so. And then you've got this amazing thing. And it's a great sort of a barbecue kind of thing where, you know, you've got that kind of slow cooked smoky thing and you're enjoying it in the backyard. And it gives the cook. And incidentally, the goulash is always supposed to be cooked by a man. Everything else is done by women.
Oh.
but the guy who cooks the thing over the fire, always the man. So while he's cooking, he has the excuse to sit and drink a whole lot of beer and wine and enjoy the, you know, chatting with the neighbors, and it's all a great time.
I could get into that, I think, yeah.
Yeah, and then you just serve it with some crusty bread and some more wine, and
do you feel through the course of researching this book that, you know, it's kind of a cliche, you got closer to your roots and all that kind of thing, but I could read in it that it meant a lot to you.
Well, you know, it really did. It meant a lot to me personally to understand what the family went through and where my background is. And it was very funny that all these things that I'd thought were never part of my life, they're not part of me, they're not who I am. And then discovering as I was doing the research and talking to people that, oh, well, yes, I guess it is, you know. But I also thought it was really interesting because there was this big, huge chunk of, you know, history in the 20th century that we don't really know that much about. You know, I mean, we know a fair bit about what happened in the Second World War and the First, but what happened during the Stalin years, what happened behind the Iron Curtain, I don't know. It was an eye-opener for me. And, you know, I mean, I'm not a historian, but what happened, the unbelievable numbers of people who died, the terrible tortures, the terrible things that people did or were forced to do was just shocking. And I have this really, I have a newfound respect for all, not just the Hungarians, not just my family, but all those people, you know, in that eastern part of Europe who just went through hell. They went through hell time and time again. And then this horrible period. And they've sort of somehow survived, their humor intact, their cuisine intact, their, you know, their strength of character intact. It's pretty awesome. You know, and now I feel really fortunate because people keep telling me their stories. And the stories are so amazing. And I just, there is this tradition in those Eastern cultures where they, or Eastern European cultures, where people don't talk about what happened. They just move on, you know? I mean, that's the sort of the motto, my grandmother's motto, which became the motto of the book. Don't look back, look forward. But, you know, I really wish those people would tell their stories because their stories are amazing. And if we forget them, then we're forgetting something really important. And I don't think that's a very good thing at all.
And luckily, I think asking them questions about food probably entices them to tell some of those stories where, you know, because they get more relaxed when they're talking about food.
Absolutely. Food is a universal language. People love to talk about food. They love to show you how to cook. They love to talk about the ingredients. They love to talk about the wine. And when you talk about any of these things in a land where there's been so much turmoil, you can't help get into the real stories as well. So you can start saying, oh, well, why is your vineyard so small? And then you get into this whole long discussion of, you know, how the property was taken away from the landowners and they got to buy it back in little parcels. And it's fascinating. And I don't know, it's the best way to travel too, because there's nothing that is on your plate that doesn't tell you the whole story of a culture, its ingredients, its geography, its climate, and its history. And, you know, what a delicious way to learn, you know, much better than, you know, reading books. Well, except mine.
Except yours, yes.
Except mine. Mine's good.
Okay, and stay tuned for information on the book. Thank you so much for showing me a couple of your dishes and sitting here and taking me through and telling me some of the stories from the book. It's great.
Well, thank you so much. This has been a lot of fun.
That was Joanne Sasvari, author of Paprika, a spicy memoir from Hungary. It is one of the best food, travel, history, and family stories all rolled together that I've ever read. If you want more information, just visit my website at dongenova.com, click on my blog, and look for the entry on Paprika. Thanks to Pat Churchill in Melbourne, Australia. She responded to my call last podcast for some good quince recipes, and I'm about to make her quince and apple pickle, which sounds delicious. Pat is a Kiwi food writer spending some time in Australia, and you can visit her website, which is aptly named cookingdownunder.com. I'm Don Genova, hoping you have happiness in the kitchen. That's all you can eat for this week. Bye for now.